Hello, everybody. You listen to J Movie Talk, episode 161, as I'll be talking Kill Bill, volume 2.
Clark Kent is how Superman views us. And what are the characteristics of Clark Kent? He's weak. He's unsure of himself. He's a coward. Clark Kent is Superman's critique on the whole human race. Sort of like Beatrix Kiddo and Mrs. Tommy Plimpton.
So the point emerges.
You would have worn the costume of Arlene Plimpton, but you were born Beatrix Kiddo. And every morning when you woke up, you'd still be Beatrix Kiddo. Oh, you can take the needle out.
Are you calling me a superhero?
I'm calling you a killer. A natural born killer. You always have been, and you always will be.
All right, everybody, I'm back for episode 161. May action continues on this month. Hope you guys have been enjoying it as much as I have. Last week, of course, I did Kill Bill Volume 1, and this week I'll be doing Kill Bill Volume 2. Now, before I actually get into talking about the movie, at first, I was kind of wavering back and forth of whether or not I should do it all as one episode or split up into two parts. And as you can tell, I decided to do it as two parts, mainly because of the fact of when the movies came out. I mean, of course, Quentin Tarantino's original idea for Kill Bill was to release it as one long continuous film. One film, of course. But, you know, for reasons and everything, they decided to split up into two parts. And even though I have never actually watched it as one long film, like in its true chronological order or whatnot, I think it plays better the way it is. Kind of similar to Pulp Fiction. For anyone who's ever seen Pulp Fiction in its true chronological order, it doesn't actually play as good, in my opinion, as it does with the way it was released, Pulp Fiction, that is. And I haven't seen, like I say, I haven't seen Kill Bill, you know, the whole bloody affair where it's released. It's basically one long film in chronological order, kind of like how they did the Godfather saga and everything. And even with the Godfather saga, I was never really a fan of it being played in chronological order because of the fact that, especially when it came to Godfather Part 2, the whole back and forth of, at that time, current day Michael and young Vito Corleone, the parallels and everything with that, I think made more sense with how it played in Godfather 2, opposed to you get all that stuff in the very beginning and then you get all the Michael stuff later on, of course, as it goes on. So coming back to Kill Bill Volume 2, that's the reason why I decided to break it up into two movies. I think it plays better as two different films, because in a way it is kind of two different films, even though there is one, you know, story, of course, with the two movies. But the movies are completely, I want to say, different as far as the style goes. Of course, in the first movie, it was very steeped in, karate and kung fu, even, say, blaxploitation movies or whatnot. It was very steeped in that type of era. Whereas when we get to Volume 2, it becomes more of like a Western type movie. And I never understood why Tarantino did that, but I enjoyed it because, me being a huge fan of Western films, and for anyone who's been a long time listener of Movie Talk, know that I do enjoy my Western movies and everything. So I always thought it was kind of interesting that he decided to change up the style, because people had got so accustomed, just in that year span, people had got accustomed to, like, oh, Kill Bill, you know, it's a martial arts type movie. And even in the second one, it still has some martial arts stuff in it, but you get away from a lot of that and go more into the Western type of film, you know, and everything, where the bride becomes this, I almost want to say like a woman with no name type in this movie. and everything, but I did think it was very interesting how he did it. So getting into the movie, basically kicks off with where we get to actually see everything that happened. Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to even do the whole thing about the cast, because the cast here is pretty much virtually the same with the exception of a few additions. So I won't go through the whole cast for this. I'll just mention the additions to this movie. So we get Michael Parks. He returns, but playing a completely different character of Esteban, a man of leisure, I should say. We also get Larry Bishop as Larry. We get Sid Haig as Jay, the bartender, as well. And we also get the introduction of the character of Bibi. We actually get to see her finally in this movie, played by actress Perla Haney Jardinia. Also, that's pretty much it as far as like the main people or whatnot I mentioned. That's the additional add-ons here. But yeah, so, well, actually also we get Bo Severance as Reverend Harmony and Jeannie Pepper as Mrs. Harmony. And of course, it wouldn't be a Tarantino film without probably, I want to say, his favorite actor that he likes to use, and that's one Samuel Jackson as
Rufus. He's the man. Rufus? Who was that you used to play for?
Rufus Thomas.
Rufus Thomas. Rufus Thomas.
I was a drill. I was a drifter. I was a coaster. I was part of the gang. I was a bar K. If they come through Texas, I done played with them.
Rufus? He's the man.
And then, of course, also to the character of Tommy, who plays a important part in this beginning part of the movie. So, getting into the movie, we get to see the actual what actually went on at the Two Pines wedding chapel, and we find out that it was not a massacre at a wedding; it was actually a wedding dress rehearsal. And we see where a pregnant bride, who's going by the name of Arlene Machiavelli, and her groom-to-be, Tommy, along with her friends and everything. And they're just kind of going through the whole rehearsal or whatnot with Reverend Harmony and his wife. And that's when we're introduced to Rufus, who's the piano player, who kind of gives a little speech about, you know, all the people that he's played for. And that's why he's the man or whatnot, which I always liked that little back and forth. And plus, you never get to see Samuel Jackson's face like clear. It's shot from behind him, so you always get him from a side angle. And this is all done in black and white. And while they're kind of going through this or whatnot, you start to hear this flute being played, which alerts Arlene, the bride, and she decides to go outside. And this is the first time that we actually see Bill face. It's him playing this flute. So I always felt like he was kind of like a harmonica character, because anytime he just kind of appears in a way, and is shot very much like that whole Once Upon a Time in the West scene, where the first time you see harmonica playing the harmonica, and then he just looks up, and because that's how it was with his character in that movie. He just appears. Usually you would hear the harmonica and then he would appear. And that's kind of how they introduce Bill here. And like I said, in the first movie, you never saw his face, and this is the first time you actually see his face and everything. So they have like this little exchange on the porch and everything, and it seems very friendly at first, but you can tell that there's some tension there. And so they go inside, and Arlene introduces Bill to Tommy as her father, and which he kind of laughs about a little bit and everything. And Tommy, you know, he was so eager to meet Bill and everything like this, and he tells him, it's like, well, you know what, you should give her away. And Bill's like, nah, I don't think so. He said, I'll just watch and everything like this. So as they go to do the go through the motions of, you know, the vows and everything, we go outside to where we see the rest of the Deadly Viper gang as they come inside, and then they shoot up the whole chapel and everything. So you kind of get more of that backstory of what happened there, because even with this, even though you get a little bit more about it, you still never actually see the whole thing play out. You still just got to get bits and pieces, even though you get more of it this go around than you did at all in the first movie. So then we fast forward to where Bill and Bud are at Bud's trailer and everything, and they're kind of talking about the fact that the bride, because we still don't know her name at this point, at least, is, you know, coming from them. And Bill basically tells Bud about what happened over, you know, what happened with Oren Ishii over in China with the whole crazy 88. And I just thought it was kind of interesting, the relationship that Bill and Bud have in this movie, because even though they're brothers, this is the only time that they actually have a scene together throughout the whole course of both films or whatnot. And Bud basically tells Bill, like, well, if she wants to come down to the club and start some shit, well, then I'll be ready. You know, I'll be ready for her, whatnot. But the way Bud is presented at the beginning of this movie is very interesting, because he just seems like someone that's kind of a broken recluse or whatnot. And it's interesting because of all of the members of the Deadly Viper gang, he's the one that we actually spend time with that doesn't revolve around the bride. So he basically lives this real crappy life, really, if you think about it. He lives out in a trailer, like way out in the middle of nowhere. He works this bullshit job as a bouncer at the strip club, and he gets treated like crap. Because when he goes in for a shift or whatnot, he shows up late, and that's where we meet Sid Haig's character, Jay, who, you know, lets him know that Larry wants to see him in his office. And then he goes back there, and Larry Bishop, who's playing this grimy ass club owner, is in his office with the stripper, and they snorting cocaine and everything like this. So Bud comes in, and he basically gets berated in front of this woman, and he actually takes it. And it never makes sense, like, why does he allow himself to be talked down to like this? Because I'm pretty sure, with the fact that not only is he a train killer and everything, I'm pretty sure he could have been living a better life than what he wanted. I mean, Vanita Green, Vivica Fox character in the first movie, she was living the life that she wanted to live. You know, a house, you know, housewife who probably still did like certain missions every now and then, but she wanted that family life. Over in Ishii, she was the boss of bosses for the Yakuza, right? That's what she wanted to be, right? And then you get L Driver, who basically was still very much in the game of assassins and stuff like this. But Bud, for some reason, he just seemed to have got away from that whole entire life. And it was, like I said, his character might be the most interesting character of them all. So after he basically gets fired in a way, he goes back to his trailer, he goes inside, and this is where we find out that the bride has been waiting at his trailer for him to come back. And she tries to sneak in on him, but not only does she try to sneak in on him, we realize that, oh, he actually knew that she was already there, because when she opens that trailer door, he shoots her flat in the chest with a shotgun. And it's like, oh shit. But it's a great shot, because she flies out of there and everything, and it gives that kind of over the top, you know, I want to say Wile E. Coyote type of sound effect, where she falls back into the dirt and everything. And basically what it was, he shot her in the chest with rock salt and everything, and he dopes her up and everything, and he gets on the phone and he calls L Driver to let her know that he has caught the woman that couldn't be caught and everything like this, and tells her to get her ass down there, and because he wanted $1 million for her and everything like that. So after this is where, well, let's talk about Michael Madsen character for a second. So just the fact that, I mean, Michael Madsen, who, you know, he was in Reservoir Dogs, you know, Tarantino's first movie is Mr. Blonde. He couldn't do Pulp Fiction because he had to do Wyatt Earp and everything like that. So this was the first time we saw Michael Madsen in a Tarantino movie since Reservoir Dogs. And I just like the fact that when he comes back into play here in Tarantino's universe, as I say, that his role is very layered. It's very multi-layered of his character, and just the way Michael Madsen plays it, I mean, it shows that he still is a good actor, just given the right material, and everything, but he showed that he could, you know, still give a really good performance and everything, because he was like a man of the 90s for a while there. He was in some good movies and everything. People kind of forget that, but he was in some good movies in the 90s. I mean, of course, with Reservoir Dogs, but also, too, he shows up in Species, even though he was also the dad in Free Willy, right, and everything. But he did have a run of being in movies in the 90s, some decent quality movies during the 90s. And then the 2000s come along, he kind of fall off, but I mean, Kill Bill does kind of bring him back to some degree, but then he kind of falls back into that whole, you know, B-movie, you know, sci-fi original run that he goes on and kind of continues on in a way. But it's good to know that Tarantino does always kind of bring him back every so often to show up in a movie, because he was in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood as well. So, but yeah, I just always find myself like paying a lot of attention to the character of Bud whenever I watch this movie. So Bud and his friend, they take the bride at this point and takes her out to the cemetery and buries her in the grave of Paula Schultz or whatnot. And there's always been like speculation, especially after Django and Chain come out, because you had Dr. King Schultz and everything. And people would like to make the connection, say that Paula Schultz was actually the wife of Dr. King Schultz and she died. And then that's why he kind of went on his, you know, thing about being a bounty hunter and this, that, and the other or whatnot. But I do find it very interesting also that even though Bud is the only one of the Deadly Vipers to get the upper hand on the bride, they never have a word with each other. Even the scenes that they're in together, he speaks, but she doesn't. And she is very interesting. And it almost feels like Bud was doing this out of loyalty to his brother. The fact that the bride basically turned her back on him and everything. So he was always, of course, going to be loyal to his brother. And just kind of this exchange that they have, this eye exchange that they have before he puts the top on the coffin to bury her. It's very, like I say, it's very layered and very deep if you really like look into it. And I always kind of wonder what was the true, like the whole backstory of Bud in general and his relationship. What was his relationship like with the bride, you know, when she was a part of, you know, the Deadly Viper gang and this, that, and the other. Like I said, some interesting stuff. So, because like Bud tells her before he puts her, you know, in the ground, he's like, well, you're going in the ground tonight. And either you can go in, you know, blind, because he was going to mace her, or you can take this here flashlight and everything. So she takes the flashlight and then they proceed to nail the coffin shut, drop her down, bury her. And I would say this is like the beginning of Tarantino and like the some of the horror-ish elements that he would start implementing in certain stuff, because even though this is all done, you don't see it. It's all in the dark. So you're kind of putting yourself in the shoes of Uma Thurman's character as she's being buried alive, and you can hear the dirt as it's hitting the coffin and everything or whatnot. But also, too, what's funny about this, around this time, Quentin Tarantino actually directed a 2-part episodes for CSI, the original CSI or whatnot, where it was called Buried. And where the character of Nick Stokes was buried in a coffin, and he was trying to, you know, trying to find him and everything. And he even got John Saxon to show up as like this maniac. They had a bomb strapped to him and whatnot. They buried Nick, and of course he kills himself to make it even harder to find him. And it's probably like one of the best episodes for the CSI franchise, in my opinion, period, because Tarantino did it. And it's funny that he directed that episode like around the time that this movie came out. So it kind of played hand in hand with that to some degree. So she basically, she's like starting to panic of the fact that she's been buried, but not really. I mean, she turns on the flashlight, kind of looks around because it is a freaking pine box. So while she's buried, it kind of goes back to the first part where she couldn't, you know, move her legs and everything, where we get this whole backstory of Ori and Ishii here. Since she's in this predicament, they decide to take us back to like her beginnings to some degree of where she is first taken to the grandmaster of Pai Mei, this old vaudevillian trainer and everything, who has disdain for people, period, or whatnot. So we kind of get this whole history of her, you know, learning how to become assassin, how to become more, you know, meticulous and, you know, being very seasoned, and just the relationship that kind of builds between them. I really like that backstory and everything, and the way it plays, and Gordon Parks, he plays it very good. Of course, the first time we saw Gordon Parks, of course, was in the first half, where he's the Johnny Moe who comes in during the whole crazy 88 fight scene, and, you know, is going after, he's like the leader of the gang, and then he's the one to get his legs chopped off and falls into the water, you know, and everything during the whole big battle. But here he plays Pai Mei, and this character is a very this character has a whole lot of history behind it, especially with the whole Japanese martial arts culture and stuff like that. So it's kind of interesting how Tarantino brings that character into his universe in a way, and just how, even though it's never said, but the fact that Pai Mei, he begins to gain respect for the bride, because he noticed that she has this determination and will to succeed, even though when he first meets her, it doesn't seem like she does. And she seems very brash and, you know, and cocky because she's an American, and he really hates American, and he hates women too. So she kind of had a double negative going against her in that regard. But during the course of the training, she gains his respect, which I like how that kind of plays out and everything. So, as that kind of goes through, and because it shows too where she learns how to break boards or whatnot, so we get that little history lesson or whatnot, and then it comes back to her in the coffin and everything, and then she starts to do that same practice of breaking the board, and she begins to break it, and then some way somehow, if she would have broke that thing with all that dirt that's on top of her, she should have died right then and there, because all that dirt should have crashed in on her and she would have been dead. But for movie purposes, she's able to shimmy her way up, and we get this whole carry shot where the hand comes out of the grave or whatnot, and she gets out of there and everything, which I always find it funny how she goes to this diner that's in the middle of nowhere, and as she's walking up, you just see dirt just flying off of her, and she walks in, just like, can I get a cup of water? And the guy just looks at her like, what the hell? So after that is where we get L Driver, Daryl Hannah's character, who in the first movie you only saw her in one freaking scene, but here we get more of her, where she shows up to Bud's trailer, and she has his money and all of this, and this is where we find, of course, this is the whole deal going down between the two of them, where she brings him the money and everything, and she tells him, he tells her exactly where the bride is buried at. And so she gets on the phone after she basically double crosses Bud, and she, as he's going through the money or whatnot, she put a Black Mamba snake in the money, and the snake strikes him, of course, in the face a couple times, which is a vicious scene in a way too, how it plays out, because that's a, it's very, because the first time you watch it, you're not expecting that. You know something kind of is kind of off, especially with how she kind of looks at him and everything like this. And you can tell that they have a hatred for each other. But when he's going through the money and like saying he picks it up and then his black mama shows up and it strikes him in the face, he throws it aside and he thrashes around a little bit and then he passes out and dies. And she gets on the phone and that's when she calls Bill and tells him that the bride has showed up and killed Bug because she put a black mama snake in his trailer, and that if he gets real sentimental about, you know, the fact that she's dead now, that she can come to the cemetery and visit the grave of Paula Schultz, because that is where you'll find Beatrix Kittle. And it's funny that Elle is the one who that they allow to be the first one to say her name in the movie, because in the first movie, anytime someone says Beatrix Kittle is blanked out and everything, but they allow Elle Driver to be the one who you hear her name for the very first time. So when she's getting ready to leave, Beatrix shows up and drops kicks her back into the trailer. They start fighting and everything like this. And they have this crazy fight between these two women, which I enjoy a lot. They really go all out in this fight. They even have a sword fight in the doggone trailer, if you can imagine that. And while in the process of you thinking that L Driver is about to get the better of Beatrix, because she is kind of like egging her on and she's kind of gaining more, where L is like smiling, just eye her down with that one good eye. And while she's doing that, Beatrix hauls off and snatches her eye out and everything. And L starts to spaz out and just fall all over the place, which is a homage to her character Pris from Blade Runner when she kind of short circuits and everything. So Tarantino basically had her do that here. And it's just crazy how that whole thing plays out. She just thrashes around. And then to make matters worse, Beatrix drops the eye on the floor and then steps on it and squishes it. So there was no remote way that she would get her eye back into her socket. Even, you know, if there was a chance to do that. So she's basically left blinded completely. And she's thrashing around as Beatrix, you know, she leaves out of the trailer and leaves her in there with the black mama snake. Now, we never see Elle die, so which I'll talk about that later. I always thought that was kind of interesting that of all of them, she's the only one that is left alive virtually and everything. But talking about Daryl Hannah in this movie. So like I said, in the first movie, she only has that one scene where she goes there to the hospital to try to kill Beatrix and everything. But, you know, Bill stops her. So that's the last time we see her, really. But this time we get a little bit more of her character. And she's an interesting character because we find out, too, that she's the one who actually killed Padme when she went to train with him, because she called him a angry old fool. And everything, and yeah, she killed Beatrix's master, and that kind of drove her over the edge a little bit too. But you would think that Beatrix would have killed her, but she doesn't kill her, so it makes you wonder even more so, why didn't she kill L Driver? Like I said, there's a little like nuggets in this movie that really makes you think a little bit deeper than what you would naturally think about when it comes to this movie. But I thought Daryl Hannah did a really good job in this movie. I mean, it was like a comeback of sorts for her as well, because I would say before this movie, we really wasn't seeing Daryl Hannah in anything of note as much at this point in time. But I mean, Tarantino, he does bring her back, and she does a damn good job in the movie. Unfortunately, she kind of fades away a little bit too after this movie comes out, in a way. Quite a few of them kind of does this as well, which I thought was kind of terrible in a way, that they kind of fade away. But I mean, we kind of know why. I would say we kind of know why things kind of go sideways with Daryl Hannah's career after this, which I won't go too much in about, but it has to do with some producer guy. But anyway, like I say, Daryl Hannah does a really good job in this movie as well. It'd have been nice to see more of that character, because she has an interesting history with her too. I know I say interesting a lot when it comes to these people, but it is. It makes you think a lot about these characters that you wouldn't necessarily think about, especially if you just watch the movie just to watch it. If you kind of watch it and dissect it, like, I would like to know a little bit more about that character, because it would explain more of why they do the things that they do, why, you know, and everything. It's a whole bunch of why do they do this, like what motivates them and everything. And that's kind of why you want to see a little bit more about those characters. So after this, Beatrix is driving like a maniac through this woods looking area and everything. And she comes upon this place called Acuna. And we find out that through narration that she's going to meet this old man of leisure, played by Michael Parks, Esteban Vallejo. And when she walks in, and they have Michael Parks dressed up, he's supposed to be playing like a Mexican type character, Colombian or whatever. And she comes in, she sits down with him, and he has the accent on, and just the way he plays this is perfect. You almost want to laugh, but you realize that you kind of forget that it's Michael Parks a little bit and realize like it's a character that he's playing. And the fact that they have a talk and everything, and he tells her that, you know, if I was still in business, you'd be my number one lady, basically like flirting with her in a way. And he tells her, like, Bill shot you in the head. No, she's like, yes. He's like, well, you know, if you would have broke my heart, I would have just cut your face and everything. I wouldn't have tried to kill you. But basically, that's what he says. Like, I would have tried to kill you. I would have cut you in the face, but I wouldn't have tried to kill you. He's like, that was kind of extreme, basically, or whatnot. And he decides to tell Beatrix where exactly Bill is. And she even asks him, like, why are you telling me this? And he tells her, say, well, Bill would want me to. And she's like, why? He said, well, just like his favorite song, how would he ever see you again? Which I always love that line, because it fades out and then she goes, you know, she leaves and she ends up going to the place where we find out this is where Bill lives. So when Beatrix shows up at the house and everything, you know, she's ready to go in with a fight or whatnot. And when she walks in, she sees Bill and little BB, who wasn't dead, like Bill told Sophie at the end of volume one, like, does she know that her daughter's still alive? Which she didn't, and no one told her this. And so when she walks in and she finds BB and Bill, you know, like, they're waiting for mommy to show up and everything, this basically disarms Beatrix in a way. And Bill does, he uses BB to disarm her, because he knew he couldn't really do it himself, and she would have came in ready to fight if BB wasn't around. But by having her daughter there, it virtually disarms her to the point of where she just kind of plays along with the game that BB is playing of, you know, shooting them and everything like this. And we get a little backstory with them and how, you know, they find, like, BB was told that mommy was sleeping and that, you know, when mommy wakes up that she would come and find her and everything like this. So Bill was basically planning for Beatrix to show up at some point. Now, did he expect, you know, her to kill as many people and all the people that she did to get to him? I don't think so, but he was expecting her to eventually to show up to his house in a way. So after they kind of take BB and put her to sleep and everything, Bill, he decides to shoot Beatrix in the knee with a damn truth serum called, I forgot exactly what the name of it was, but it's basically a truth serum. And he starts asking her questions and everything. And to much of Beatrix's dislike, she has to tell the truth to these questions. And then we get one of my favorite scenes is where Bill tells her the Superman speech. And it is virtually true. Of course, there's a few exceptions to it, but for the purpose of the story and comparing it to Beatrix, it is very much true that whenever Clark Kent wakes up, he's always Superman. even though he pretends to be Clark. But he was born Kal-El, son of Jal-El, all that other good stuff. But he will always be Superman. And the, you know, the clothes that he was sent to Earth in, you know, those is his actual clothes. The costume that he pretends to be is actually that of Clark Kent, and about not being sure of himself and this, that, and the other. And that's when he comes back to comparing Superman to Beatrix, saying that no matter what, if she would have tried to pretend to be Arlene Machiavelli in Texas and everything, she would have, that was her costume, that was her Clark Kent, but she will always have been naturally Beatrix Kittle. She would have always been a natural born killer, which with that line always strikes a chord with me, because that's the first time where, in a way, where Tarantino even makes reference to natural born killers in his movie, because of the fact that he basically disowns that movie, even though the story is by him, but that is not his movie. That is clearly Oliver Stone's movie. And I always felt like, because of that, that was the last time that anyone not named Tarantino directed anything that was written by Tarantino. Because, I mean, Tony Scott does a great job with True Romance. I would say that is the most Tarantino movie that's written by Tarantino, that's not directed by Tarantino. But then Oliver Stone, he decides to do this crazy elaborate thing with Natural Born Killers, which, even though I enjoy that movie for what it is, but it's not a Tarantino story at all. But this was like the first time where Tarantino like acknowledges, you know, natural born killer or whatnot. And it's always kind of interesting that that plays out like that. So after that, we get where Beatrix has a flash, basically tells Bill like what exactly happened to her after, you know, why she disappeared. And we get this flashback of her on an assignment. She's going to kill somebody or whatnot. And she's in a hotel room and she finds out that's when she's pregnant or whatnot. And an assassin was sent to kill her, who had spotted her when she first got there. So she gets into this whole kind of back and forth with this woman who's outside with this big shotgun and everything. And Beatrix basically tells her like that she's pregnant and that she's leaving and that she can just leave too and won't be any type of hassle from anybody. And that's basically what happens after that whole exchange. She basically flees and ends up in Texas and meets up with Tommy and get these new friends and was going to try to live this, you know, great little simple life until Bill tracked her down. And it's funny when Bill tells that story, he said, I wasn't tracking you down. So I was tracking down the no good, you know, sons of bitches that I thought had killed you or whatnot. He's saying, but then I show up and there you are. There you are. And then you're pregnant and everything. And then say, and I love that line too, because he's drunk the whole time. He says, and having somebody think that you're dead when you're not is cruel or whatnot. It's just funny how he says that line. And Beatrix at this point is still like angry at him because that true sermon is starting to wear off to some degree. And they're sitting outside at this point. And she's like, you and I have some unfinished business. And he's like, baby, you ain't kidding. And then we get this kind of fight scene where they're sitting down at this table and they kind of go back and forth or whatnot. And I always say, because Bill is drunk, this is why this even happens, because she blocks him. And she ends up hitting him with the 5-point palm strike in the chest, which is where you hit the 5 points. And it basically, you take a few steps after that and then your heart explodes and you die. And we find out that Pai Mei had taught her this when he didn't teach that to anybody, even though it's set up, you know, that this move exists and everything, but he doesn't teaches it to anybody. But it's because of the fact that he gained so much respect for Beatrix that he did teach her, and she didn't tell anybody, because Bill even says, well, why didn't you tell me? And she's like, I don't know. And So Bill, he realizing that he's going to die or whatnot. So he's like, how do I look? And she's like, ready. And he gets up, he takes some steps, and then he falls out dead. Now, I will say this. Going by how Beatrix goes about taking out all of the deadly vipers, I would say that how Bill dies is probably my least favorite of it, even though it's more sentimental and more emotional. But I would have rather seen more of a fight, especially when he's the one who shot her in the head and everything. You would think that she would have did him probably the worst of them. And also, too, it's funny that of all of them, she never gets into an actual fight with Bud. And even though L Driver is presumed, and I put quotation marks when I say that, presumed to have probably been killed by the Black Mamba Snake, but we really don't know. But Bud is like the one that she doesn't even get into a true conversation with, because he's the one who actually captures her. And that just lets you know what type of person that Bud was. If he was able to be the one to capture her, why couldn't everybody else do it? So there was something a little bit more special about him that, like I said, always gets overlooked. But yeah, I never really liked Bill's ending. I mean, I understand it, but I always kind of wanted a little bit more from their fight. Because that's what the whole movie is based around. It's called Kill Bill, you know, the revenge to get him. Just got to go through all these other people because he was the one who orchestrated the whole thing. But he kind of gets the, I want to say, the most lackluster kill of them all, in a way. But speaking of David Carradine, he does a really good job in this role. I mean, this was a comeback for him, too, because he had been kind of forgotten about. I mean, after the whole Kung Fu TV series, which even though I watched it as a kid, I mean, I think a lot of people of a certain age watched Kung Fu when they was a kid. You know, but it still was kind of tongue in cheek and like not to be taken too serious. And this is David Carradine at this point. And, you know, he kind of became like somewhat of a joke in a way. But this movie brings him back to being like, oh, David Carradine, oh, he can be taken serious. I mean, this dude, you know, what, he's in Tarantino movie, you know, and this, that, and the other. And he did get a lot of praise for this. But just like some of the other actors from this movie, their career, you would have thought it would have brought them back in a good fashion, but it didn't. This is kind of like the last truly great thing that most of the known actors of this movie actually do. And I always find that very interesting for whatever reason. Let's say just looking at their filmographies, you get to Kill Bill, and then after Kill Bill, you would think that maybe they would have did a lot more high profile stuff, but they kind of don't and everything for whatever reason, or whatnot. But, I thought David Carradine, he does a great job as Bill, and he presents himself as like the big ultimate boss that you have to face or whatnot, even though you get this lackluster death scene with him. But it just, he has a good blend of menace, even compassion, especially the scenes with him and BB, where he's the father. You get to see this gentler side of him or whatnot when he's dealing with her, and everything. So there's multi layers to his character as well and everything. So that's pretty much it. I mean, we get this happy story of, you know, Beatrix and BB riding off into the sunset and, you know, going to live a better life. And of course, there's always been the rumor of a third Kill Bill movie that will revolve around the character of Nikki coming back to strike revenge on Beatrix. And who knows, because of the fact that that line is said in the first film about her, she still feels raw about the fact that Beatrix killed her mother, you know. When she's old enough, she could come back and, you know, she'd come looking for her. She'd be waiting. Now, with that being said, do you think that Beatrix would train BB to be like a assassin as well? I mean, not to the extent of what she was, but to the extent of knowing how to fight and all this type of stuff. Just train her, you know, train her up in a way. And because Beatrix would be an older woman at that point, and but you have your daughter there at least to kind of combat Nikki in a way. There's like a lot of story ways you could go about this. And plus two, who's to say that Vanita Green was actually dead? Yeah, she gets stabbed in the chest, but they could always bring her back. And who's to say that L Driver is dead? She could always come back. I mean, of course, she would be the woman with no eyes, but we don't see this Black Mamba thing killed her. And you don't know if anybody even shows up out there, buzz trailer, and finds her or something like that. We don't know. There's like a lot of open openings for them to do a third movie. And Tarantino has always kind of toyed around with a third movie being made. But also at the same time, he says that his 10th film will be his last film. And do you really want to end your filmmaking career with a sequel to a movie that didn't necessarily warrant a sequel? Because if he really wanted to, I'm pretty sure he could have done Kill Bill Volume 3 a long time ago. But after this movie, this is where he kind of starts his, I want to say, once upon a time fable-ish era of making movies. Because you get, because after this you get Inglourious, well, not after, well, you get Grindhouse, actually. That's kind of placed in there. But also, too, you get Inglourious Basterds. You get Django Unchained, which is a once upon a time-ish type of a story. You get, well, Inglourious Basterds is a once upon a time-ish tale as well. You get The Hateful Eight. And then, of course, you get Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which was his latest film. So would you really want to end things with Kill Bill necessarily? So I guess it's still kind of a wait and see of what exactly will be his 10th film. And if he even will retire after he makes his 10th film, we don't know. It's kind of one of those, we just have to wait and see type of things. So, to end this out, to talk about Uma Thurman, discuss her, of course, in the first movie, but the second time around here, I feel like we get even more about her backstory, her inner workings, the things that make her kind of tick, why they decided not to have her have more of a battle with Bill, I don't know. And everything, but I thought Uma Thurman did a really good job in this movie. And I even said in the first volume one, I said it when I was talking about that movie, where even though I was never really a huge Uma Thurman fan before the Kill Bill movies, I thought that with this movie, this would have kind of elevated her and propelled her to doing a variety of more type of roles. And it didn't, in a way, because she falls into that category just like Michael Madsen, Daryl Hannah, Vivica A. Fox, David Carradine, where they don't go on to do, I would say, anything of this high of a quality of film after this. The only one who does to some degree is Lucy Liu. If you can believe that, she's like the only one who really kind of is propelled after this. And of course, Charlie Angels had come along at that time too, so it's probably most off the back of Charlie Angel than necessarily Kill Bill. But for purposes of discussion, I'm saying she's like the only one of the main cast that goes on to still, you know, make some high quality movies and things of that nature, where you see her, and then of course she goes into a hit TV show of Elementary and everything, playing Watson, right? But I would have liked to see more from Uma Thurman, doing more, you know, badassery type roles and things like that, because I thought she did a really good job playing Beatrix Kiddo. You really find yourself, you know, rooting for her, and it's kind of a rarity in a lot of movies too, where you wholeheartedly root for the main character to some degree, but you do really want her to succeed in her revenge tale here, which she does, or whatnot. And just the way Uma plays it, you just really kind of get in her corner, virtually. But there is a stark contrast between Beatrix Kiddo Volume 2 and Beatrix Kiddo Volume 1. Now, in Volume 1, she's just kind of trying to figure things out. you know, she's lost and confused because she has a 4-year gap, you know, or whatnot of time loss. But volume two, Beatrix, she's like, I'm pretty sure this is the person she was before she decided to leave and, you know, try to leave just a simple life with her unborn child at that time. And just how she interacts with people, even though we don't get a lot of dialogue from her in this movie or whatnot, where we do in the first movie, we get a little bit more, but she kind of doesn't do a lot of talking because she's almost like the woman with no name to some degree. She's very, because once again, it plays like a Western in a way. So she doesn't have to do a lot of talking. She's just more about the action in this movie, which she does do a lot of freaking action in this movie. And everything, but I enjoy her performance in both. Just it's funny how she kind of plays the character just a little bit different in each movie, because that's what the movie entails. Volume one entails her to be one way, volume two entails her to be a different way, or whatnot. So if I had to rate this movie, I probably would give it a solid 4 out of 5, which is on par with the first one, as well. Like I said, very entertaining. It is funny that even though I've seen volume two more than I've seen volume one, I kind of remember a lot of stuff about volume one more so than I do about volume two, which is kind of weird. I guess because volume two is a little bit more layered than volume one is. There's more things at play, whereas volume one is kind of straightforward and is just build up to the two big fights and there's like breaks in between. Whereas volume two, you get all this stuff with Bud, and then of course it slows down with everything with Bill and BB, and also with her going to meet Esteban Vallejo and everything like that. So it slows down a little bit. So like I say, it plays like a Western in a way, whereas the first one is just like set up premise, battle, big fight, set up premise, stalk, big fight, in a way. So, so like I say, even though it's one big story, but it's like two different movies virtually and everything, which I enjoy that. If I had to pick a favorite character, I would go with the character of Bud, actually, because like I say, he's the most interesting character, in my opinion, of all of them throughout the whole big story, because it makes you wonder what exactly drove him to the point of where he just want to be this kind of recluse who doesn't have a problem being this bouncer at a strip club in some rundown neighborhood, and he allows himself to get talked down to by some piece of trash club owner and everything, when he's this badass assassin that he's the only man or woman to, you know, be able to get the upper hand on the most deadliest woman in the world. He's the one who got the upper hand on her. What is it about him that makes him be able to do that and everything? Because even with his character, everything with him is kind of smoke and mirrors. What we see of him is just like this rundown, beat up dude, but that's his cover. There's something about him that is very mysterious, that everyone has characters kind of at face value. You know what you're getting with him. Him, on the other hand, he's very much he's a deceptor. And that's what makes him that more interesting or whatnot. So that's pretty much it. I want to thank you guys for listening to this episode. Hope you enjoyed me talking about the two Kill Bill films and everything, as well as the first movie that I kicked off May Action with, which was Haywire. For episode 162, I'll be closing out talking about the movies, at least, where I talk about the movie Atomic Blonde and everything. So that'll be the close out of the movies. And then I'll probably end May with an episode talking about just women in action movies in general, type of thing. And then I'll be getting ready for June, because I already have June planned out, which I planned out June. Well, I planned out May Action months in advance as well, but I planned out June a month in advance as well. So be on the lookout for what I have planned for June after I finish up with May action with the ladies, of course. Of course, you can find me on Twitter at JMovieTalk. You can find me also on Instagram at JMTPodcast. And of course, you can find all of the Movie Talk episodes as part of the TV Zone Podcast Network. The whole site, of course, is Anchor, but we're also on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, pretty much all of the podcaster apps out there. Just type in TV Zone Podcast Network and it'll come up and you'll find all of the content that we have on the network and everything. And of course, if you have any personal suggestions for me or anything, you can either hit me up on Twitter or you can email me at jmovietalk@gmail.com. And if you have any suggestions for movies or, you know, topics you would like for me to discuss on the podcast, you know, just let me know and everything. And also too, on iTunes, please give us some reviews. Be greatly appreciated. It helps not only for to let us know how good of a job we're doing on the network, but also too, like, you know, it helps us be a little bit more notice and everything like that. So thank you guys again for listening, and I will be back for episode 162. Peace.